Salutations, sports nerds. It's time for another episode of War on Hot Takes, the podcast for data-driven discussion of your Washington and Baltimore sports, presented by Capital News Service. I'm Adam Zelanka, and with me is Dylan Sin. This is our second episode, and if you'd like to check out our first one, you can find us on SoundCloud, check out our Twitter account, at War on Hot Takes, and make sure to visit cnsmaryland.org.
We have a packed show for you today. We're going to discuss the Washington Mystics of the WNBA and their conference finals series against the dominant Minnesota Lynx. We'll also have our fellow CNS reporter Chris Rogers later on to discuss the state of quarterback play in the NFL relative to their salaries. Spoiler alert, it's not good.
No.
We'll focus on Kirk Cousins and Joe Flacco and how they fit in the league's hierarchy. But first, we are going to get into some baseball talk today, specifically the Baltimore Orioles and the Washington Nationals, your two favorite home state teams. The Orioles have lost six in a row. About a week ago, they were within striking distance of a playoff spot, though still several spots behind the top wildcard teams. Now they have, as we said, lost six in a row. They're 4.5 games out with just 17 games left to play, meaning that their elimination number, let's call it the opposite of a magic number, is now down to 14. So that's combined Minnesota Twins victories and Orioles losses will eliminate the Orioles from the playoffs.
Now, why is it the Minnesota Twins, Dylan?
Because the Twins are the second wild card team. The Yankees lead the wild card. The Twins are in second place. The Orioles now sit all the way down in eighth. So they have several teams to leapfrog over if they are going to make a run. This last week has been particularly frustrating for the Orioles. They have lost the last three games by scores of, let me see if I have it here, 3-2, 4-3, 3-2, and 4-2.
Gosh.
That is it infuriating, I'm sure, for the Orioles. They've lost several difficult games over the last week. Just last night, normally lights-out closer Zach Britton blew his second save of the season. The Blue Jays scored two in the ninth to take that game from the Orioles and send them to a sixth straight loss.
I want to jump in here and say that last week they played the New York Yankees and the Cleveland Indians, two teams, especially the Indians, with their 20-game winning streak. Both of those teams are playoff spots right now. They are already, if the season were to end today, we will use that phrase. But the Toronto Blue Jays are not good at all. This is where you think that Baltimore, if they had some juice left in the tank in September, if they really wanted to turn things around, now is the time to do it,
right?
Playing against the Blue Jays. They're on the road in Canada, but the Blue Jays are many games under 500 behind Baltimore.
That's exactly right. And Baltimore, now they have had this season, one thing about Baltimore is they've had the most difficult schedule of any team in baseball.
Really?
Their opponent's winning percentage this season is 508 or 0.8 percentage points above 500.
Okay.
So that's obviously the best in the league, although they can't really use that excuse this week because they are playing the Blue Jays. Now, next, after they have one more game against the Blue Jays tonight with Kevin Gausman on the mound, the big right-hander. After that, they travel to New York to take on the Yankees.
Again.
More Yankees games the rest of the season, except for two against Pittsburgh late in the year. The rest of the season is against AL East opponents, the Red Sox, the Yankees, and the Rays. So they have four games coming up against the Yankees. That series is where they really are going to have to make their mark. Otherwise, it's pretty much curtains for the Orioles season, which at two different times this year, at the beginning and about a few weeks ago, it seemed like they really had a shot of getting into the playoffs again.
Disappointing for local fans, I'd say. And, you know, when you lose a handful of one-run games and two-run games the way that they have recently, a lot of times that's just luck in other sports. Would you say that with baseball, I know you said Britton blew a save this week, but is luck some small part of it when it's that close?
It's not even a small part, Adam. And research and statistics show the winning one-run games or two-run games is not really a skill that any teams have. Obviously, the old adage is good teams win close games, but that's not exactly true. Good teams
not mathematically
win,
true.
Good teams win blowouts.
Yeah.
Exactly. So the Orioles, they've lost a bunch of one-run games here. That doesn't mean that they're not clutch or anything like that. They've just simply had some bad luck in the last few games, and over the course of a long season, that's going to even out. But in a small sample size, like over the past week, it's been really tough for them to lose several such games in such a short time.
Talking about sample size, it's really interesting to me how both of the local major league teams have been affected by the two complete opposite streaks that other teams outside of Baltimore, Washington, in Major League Baseball haven't been having, in terms of the Cleveland Indians, which 20 games in, going for 21, the AL record today, against Detroit.
As we speak, they are ahead 4-1 in the fifth inning. So they
are on top of the score.
Four innings away from an AL record for victories are the is Cleveland.
So the Indians affect Baltimore because the Indians swept Baltimore as part of the streak, which hurts Baltimore's playoff chances a ton. And the Dodgers, on the other side of things, in the National League, the Dodgers, which, what's the number now, 17 of the last 18 or 16?
16 of the last 18. They finally got a win last night against the San Francisco Giants, yes.
The Dodgers have cratered, which opens up home field advantage possibility for your Washington Nationals. Dylan, what do you think of the chances the Nationals can actually steal home field advantage in the playoffs by finishing with the best record and winning the pennant in the NL? Over LA.
If you'd asked me 2 weeks ago, I would have said that it was
zero,
essentially impossible. Absolutely. Yeah. The Dodgers looked like they were one of the best teams in baseball history. Now they've lost 16 of their last 18, as Adam said, and the Nationals are only four games out. Now, the issue for the Nationals is 2 days ago, they clinched their division. 2.5 weeks of the season to go. The Nationals have already clinched. They're in the playoffs. So it depends on how hard Dusty Baker wants to go after that home field advantage. Does he want to ride his guys all the way to the end and say, we are going to go and we're going to try to get home field in the NLCS should the Dodgers get there? Or does he pull back a little bit and say, let's rest, let's get healthy? Nationals have had several nagging injuries this season. Steven Strasburg has been hurt. Max Scherzer has been hurt several times. Bryce Harper has been hurt and he's still not back. Trey Turner has been hurt. Anthony Rendon, as we talked about last week, has been basically the one constant.
Yeah.
But it depends on whether Dusty Baker prioritizes home field or his team's health going into the postseason.
Well, Dylan, you're the baseball expert. Which one would you choose if you're Dusty?
I would definitely choose going into the playoffs healthy. Now, obviously, Dusty Baker, I'm a Cubs fan. Dusty Baker had something of a similar dilemma in 2003. He rode Kerry Wood and Mark Pryor hard down the stretch, pitched them over 100 pitches several times when it was their first full season for both of them at the time. And I'm sure he might have learned his lesson, although maybe he's not thinking that far back. But I would have if I was him, because I still think about that.
Always count on Dylan Sin for Chicago Cubs reference. We're going to see 1 week from today where both of these races stand in terms of the NL pennant and the AL wild card for your Nationals and your Orioles. Now, in our next segment, when we come back, we are going to talk about a completely different sport, one that hopefully you are paying a little bit of attention to because it's playoff time. That is WNBA basketball. The Washington Mystics are facing the Minnesota Lynx in the conference finals, or the WNBA semifinals, whichever you prefer to call it with the new playoff rules. And I'm going to talk with Dylan a little bit about the Mystics. They lost game one against Minnesota last night. How much of a chance do they have to win that series in advance to the WNBA finals when we come back?
Hello and welcome back to War on Hot Takes, and now we're going to get into a topic that we haven't talked about in our first couple episodes here, and that is WNBA basketball. Your hometown Washington Mystics are in the playoffs. They are in the semifinals. That's not the Eastern Conference semifinals. That is the semifinals, the second to last round before the championship. Yep. And they are taking on, in that round, the Golden State Warriors of the WNBA. That's who they are, the Minnesota Lynx. Last night was game one, and Adam, it wasn't really particularly close.
Not really. The Minnesota won the game 101-81 over Washington, but it wasn't even that close necessarily, because after three quarters, Washington trailed 84-56, a 28-point discrepancy there. And it's a bit of a disappointment for the Mystics because they had a really strong showing in each of their first two playoff games. In the first round, a single elimination round, they beat the Dallas Wings, but then in the second single elimination round, they faced off with the New York Liberty, the best team in the Eastern Conference during the regular season. And they won that game too, but it was on the back of Christy Tolliver, who broke the WNBA playoff record for three-pointers in a game with nine. She finished with 34 points as the Mystics rolled into the semifinals. Now, the thing about this, though, is, like you said before, Minnesota is just a very good team. Tolliver was held one game after going for 34 points. She was held to three last night. She was 1 of 7 shooting from the field and 1 of 2 from three. One three-pointer was all she could muster. Now, Elena Delladonna is having a good postseason, too. She's, of course, here in Washington for the first season in her career since being traded from Chicago Sky right before the regular season kicked off. Delladonna, a Delaware, University of Delaware alum. Nice and home here in Delmarva region, right? But
exactly.
Delladonna, she's gotten better every season of her pro career in terms of, when you look at her career, playoff points per game. Because in her rookie season, 2013, for Chicago, she scored 15 points per game, and in 2014 rose a little bit, 16.8 points per game. In 15, it was 21.7 points per game for Belladonna in the playoffs. In 2017, this guy missed the playoffs in 2016, but in 2017 so far, she's had 20 points per game. The truth is, with the Mystics, that you got to make shots to win games. As unscientific as that sounds, as basic as that sounds, you got to make shots to win games. And the reason we say that is because Minnesota's got the best defensive team in this association, Dylan.
One thing that we saw when we were looking at this is that, yes, the Mystics shot actually 42.9% from behind the three-point line, which at the time, when you look at it, doesn't look too bad. But the Lynx were so good on defense. Tolliver, as Adam, you said, was just 1-for-2 from behind the three-point line after making 9 threes in her last game. So she wasn't exactly missing the mark. She was just so well defended by the Lynx that she wasn't even getting the chance to take any shots, or many, beyond the three-point line. And that goes to show you how good the Lynx are on defense. This year they had, as Adam said, the best defensive rating of any team in the WNBA. They gave up 94.1 per 100 possessions. Now that is significantly better than the second place Los Angeles Sparks in 96. It has been very difficult for the Mystics to get going, or it was in the first game. They need to move the ball around a little bit more in order to get Tolliver open, and hopefully Belladonna can be an integral part of that.
During the regular season, the Mystics scored 25% of their points from three-pointers, second most in the WNBA, behind, I believe, just the Seattle Storm.
That's right.
So when the threes don't fall, when they do fall, this is my point, when they do fall, they're a very tough team to beat, as they showed teams like the New York Liberty. They're a tough team to beat when everything's firing on all cylinders. And when the shots aren't falling, especially the threes, especially from somebody like Kristy Tolliver, who can be an X factor, it's a different story. When you're facing the Golden State Warriors of the WNBA, you can't be on anything except your A game. One thing I'd say the Washington Mystics do have going for them is that they're consistently a good rebounding team during this postseason. They went up against New York Liberty, and the Liberty had the best rebounds per game in the regular season across the WNBA. They had 38.7 rebounds per game. Washington, top five with 36.3, kind of close. But not only did the Mystics out-rebound the Liberty in their game last Sunday, 37-33, on the offensive glass, Washington had 14 rebounds and New York only took 3. It was a big discrepancy on the offensive rebounding margin there. And in game one, Washington against Minnesota's game one, I should say, it wasn't super different. Minnesota did out-rebound Washington just a little bit, 31-27, but Washington won on the offensive glass once again. They had 10 against 8 for Minnesota. And I think if you're getting those second chances on offense, you take the ball, you know, you're significantly closer, you don't need to shoot a 3, you just got to make the buckets. So we're going to see, game 2 is Thursday night, we're going to see how the Mystics perform, and it's also in Minnesota. Game 3 eventually will be in Washington. We're going to have to see how this goes, Don.
Hopefully they'll stay alive long enough for us to have another WNBA segment next week
on
our next episode.
It would be great, I think. We got to give everybody some coverage.
Exactly, and in order to do that, they're really going to have to step up their game against, as we said, one of the best teams, or the best team in the WNBA. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see how this rest of the series plays out.
And quickly, if the Mystics do come back and take this in 4 games or 5 games, on the other side of the semifinals, you have the LA Sparks and the Phoenix Mercury. Excuse me, I almost said the Phoenix Suns. Phoenix and Los Angeles. Los Angeles took the first game yesterday by a score of 79-66. And that's the team with Candace Parker. Phoenix has Brittany Griner. You'll remember these names primarily from women's college basketball. But they have great pro careers going for them, and we're going to have to watch closely as these playoffs wind down. Now, in our last segment today, we're going to be talking to Chris Rogers, our colleague at CNS, about a story he did about quarterback salaries and how they relate to actual quarterback performance. And we're going to specifically hone in on everybody's two favorites, Kirk Cousins and Joe Flacco. Right, Dylan?
That's exactly right. We'll find out for sure if Joe Flacco is elite, or at least when he cashes his checks.
And here we are. We've returned to the War on Hot Takes podcast, segment number 3 of the day. I want you to think about quarterback performance for a second. Not always is it the case that the best quarterbacks in the league are the most high-paid quarterbacks in the league, and vice versa. The best-paid quarterbacks in the league are often pretty average. And a CNS investigation this month found that many mediocre quarterbacks are earning the NFL's top salaries, It's an article on cnsmaryland.org called NFL Teams Are Breaking the Bank on Average Quarterbacks. And the reporter who did the research and writing in the entire project, his name is Chris Rogers. He's here with us now. Chris, how you doing?
I'm good. How are you doing, Adam?
Good. Thanks so much for joining us. I found your graph in particular, but your article overall, to be really fascinating. Tell us briefly about the methodology you used to go about doing this and what this scatter plot I'm looking at really shows.
So the idea first came to me really about 2 weeks ago when Matthew Stafford signed the monster extension with Detroit. And that came on the heels of Derek Carr signing an extension in June with the Raiders. And both of these quarterbacks, they're definitely competent, but they're not Tom Brady, they're not Matt Ryan, they're not Aaron Rodgers. And so that got me thinking, what are these guys actually worth? So I went through and looked at all of the starting quarterbacks on each team's depth chart as of week one. So this is guys like Tom Savage, who already has been replaced by Deshaun Watson.
Very quickly.
So I looked at every starting quarterback for all 32 teams and then took out some outliers, guys like Dak Prescott or Jared Goff, who really have too small of a sample size to evaluate them on their actual talent. So I looked at every starting quarterback that had at least 2 years of NFL experience and 600 career passing attempts. And what I found is guys at the top, like Matt Ryan, Tom Brady, that have the best average quarterback rating over the past 4 years, are really in the middle of the pack when it comes to total salary or average annual salary. And Matthew Stafford gets $27 million per year on his new contract, and he has an average quarterback rating under 60 over the last 4 years, which puts him on par with someone like Mike Glennon, underneath Jay Cutler or Andy Dalton. So it's just really interesting to look at guys like Stafford and Carr, who don't have the pedigree of a lot of these other quarterbacks, and yet they're the ones getting top dollar.
Yeah, I found that really interesting too. And my question was, other than you just talked about Stafford and Carr already got paid, who are some of the other outliers that you found? Because obviously most of the people, Brady's near the top, Rodgers is near the top, Drew Brees is near the top. Who did you find that were some of the outliers that are maybe getting paid more than they're worth or not getting paid as much as they're worth?
It's interesting because you look at the top five quarterbacks in terms of salary, and it's Stafford, it's Carr, it's Drew Brees, it's Andrew Luck, and it's Kirk Cousins. And Brees, obviously, is one of the best in the game, probably right there behind Brady. But someone like Kirk Cousins, who definitely helped Washington return to relevance in the past couple years, but he's not elite by any standard, and he's getting $24 million a year, partially because of the franchise tag. But I found this interesting because you look at someone like Stafford, who is kind of equivalent to Cousins, maybe even a little worse, and he's getting $27 million a year. And when Cousins hits free agency next year, this sets him up for a monster payday. So I found that as an interesting outlier. But then you also look at someone like Tyrod Taylor of Buffalo, who has an average QBR over the last 4 years up around 70. But this can be a little misleading because he's only had a couple years as a starter with Buffalo. He was the backup behind Joe Flacco in Baltimore for a long time. So it's a much smaller sample size, but he's got a QBR up near 70 and is only making about $15 million a year, which is significantly less than guys like Phillip Rivers or Ben Roethlisberger or Russell Wilson, who are putting up similar numbers.
And can you just encapsulate for people listening who might not know what a QBR actually entails?
QBR is total quarterback rating. It's a statistic originally put together by ESPN about 10 years ago, around 2005 or 6, because passer rating has often been used to evaluate quarterbacks, but that only looks at their passing attempts, and QBR looks at really the quarterback's whole ability on the field. So it includes passing, it includes running. So that gives guys like Russell Wilson, who are more of a dual threat, it looks at their whole ability to impact the game.
This is obviously a Maryland, D.C. sports show. Everyone wants to know about our guys, Joe Flacco and Kirk Cousins. Where do they rank? You talked about Cousins a little bit, but where does Flacco rank in terms of his salary versus his QBR? What did you find on that?
Joe Flacco has an average QBR under 60, which I'm going to say it is not elite. He's definitely in the lower half of quarterbacks in terms of QBR over the last 4 years, yet he's getting paid $22 million, which is in the upper echelon. And I talked about this in the article, but a big reason for this, and a big reason for a lot of these paydays, is just timing. So Flacco signed this extension in March of 2013, about a month after he led the Ravens to Super Bowl. It was just one of those things that was great timing for Flacco and not as great timing for the Ravens and really every other team that then had to match these salaries afterward, because the Ravens had no choice but to pay Flacco, who just won them a Super Bowl. They can't let him walk. And this really set the stage for everyone else. But I think that is a lot of the methodology behind why Flacco is paid so high, is because he has the Super Bowl. And for Cousins, like I talked about earlier, it's more of the franchise tag thing. He and Washington have talked about signing a long-term deal over the past couple years, and they can just never come to an agreement. The franchise tag keeps going up year after year, and now it's around $24 million, and so he's getting paid this elite salary on just a one-year deal.
Chris Rogers, thank you very much for being here with us today. We will tweet out your article on the @WarOnHotTakes Twitter account. That'll be up there in just a little bit. And thank you again for being here.
Thank you, Dylan. Thank you, Adam. It's been a pleasure.
All right. Now, before we get going here, we are going to give you, while we're talking about Baltimore and Washington football, we're going to give you one player to watch for each of the games this weekend.
That's right, Dylan. And I decided to make my pick based on a Twitter poll we put up earlier today. And we got a vote on Jordan Reed as somebody to cover here. Jordan Reed did not have a superb week one. He had 5 catches for 36 yards in the Philadelphia Eagles game last week. The only receiving touchdown, in fact, that Washington had from Kirk Cousins was the running back, Chris Thompson. None of the receivers or tight ends caught a ball. Crowder, Jamison Crowder, who I hyped up last week, he only had 17 yards in a disappointing season opener. Terrell Pryor had 66 yards as in his debut with Washington. To me, that means Jordan Reed really needs to be the X factor for this offense if the receivers on either side of him are going to get off to a slow start. You can't expect Chris Thompson to catch a touchdown every single game. Now, here's the thing. Washington is going to be playing the Los Angeles Rams. We're going to get that right all the time now.
Yes, we are. That is a podcast goal.
Yes, all the time. The Rams, they don't do very much well. They did kill the Colts last week. Pretty badly beat them down. But
tells you something about the Colts.
It tells you more about the Colts than the Rams, in my opinion. But the Rams are not known for doing a lot of football things well. But last year, they defended against tight ends pretty darn well. They gave up the third fewest catches and the fourth fewest receiving yards to tight ends throughout the 2016 regular season. Jordan Reed should be immune to defenses like that. He should be, if he's to be considered one of the 3 or 5 best tight ends in the league, like we all think he is, he should be immune to that and be able to beat an above average or a good defense. So I'm telling you to watch Jordan Reed next week in the Washington game. Dylan, you've got a guy from Baltimore we should be looking at.
Baltimore had a little bit more success than Washington in the first week.
Yeah.
They beat the Bengals 20-0. It was the team's first shutout since 2009, since the glory days of the Ravens defense, and it seems like that might be back now. And leading the charge is someone who was there in 2009, is still there. That would be linebacker Terrell Suggs, or as they referred to him on the broadcast this week, future Hall of Famer Terrell Suggs. So did you hear that? Terrell, it is a done deal. Congratulations, you're going to Canton. As we saw this week, Terrell Suggs, he had 2 sacks. Andy Dalton was running for his life the entire game against that Ravens defense. Suggs had 2 sacks. The Ravens overall had 5, and Dalton threw 4 interceptions. Now this week, against the Cleveland Browns, the Ravens will have to keep that pressure on because Cleveland's rookie quarterback, DeShone Kizer, looked very good in week one against the Steelers. He was unflappable. He threw a touchdown. He ran for a touchdown. He kept it close, which for the Browns, any moral victories are actual victories for the Browns, as we well know. So he was very poised and calm, and if the Ravens are going to make it 2-0, they're going to need to get the pressure on Kizer and keep it on, and that's why we're going to be watching Suggs this weekend. Now, one more thing before we go. We just like to mention that last week we talked about the Ravens and how they have the most pass-heavy offense over the last few years, and what did they do this weekend, Adam?
They ran the ball so many times. Do you have the numbers in front of you?
I do have the numbers right there.
It's as if John Harbaugh listened to the podcast last week. That's what I'd like to tell myself anyway, but Joe Flacco did not throw his arm off in week one.
Flacco threw the ball 22 times and they ran the ball 42 times. That is nearly a 2-to-1 margin.
That's what I get for insulting Javorius Buck Allen.
That's right. Well, thank you again for joining us today on this episode of War on Hot Takes. Again, you can follow us on Twitter at War on Hot Takes. We will post Chris Rogers' article on quarterbacks as soon as we are done here. So, anything else you'd like to say, Adam?
No.
He's not the best color guy in the league for nothing, folks. Anyway, anyone over 40 will get that reference. Thank you all again for joining us, and we will see you next week.